There has been a lot of discussion recently in the district about repeat violent offenders, in particular individuals who commit violent crimes while supposedly being monitored in the criminal justice system. A federal agency oversees offenders on probation and parole in D.C., an unusual system which is part of the patchwork of federal agencies, judges, and local law enforcement, making up the district's criminal justice system. Joining us to discuss those challenges is Nancy Weir. She is the director of the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency for the District of Columbia, also known as CSOSA. Nancy Weir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yours is the federal agency monitoring offenders here in D.C. Tell us a little bit about CSOSA and what its role is in the D.C. criminal justice system.
Happy to do that. Well, CSOSA stands for Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency for the District of Columbia, and our business is public safety, so we're always extremely concerned about violent crime in D.C., and we focus very closely on supervision of those under our purview. Our staff work and live here, as do I, so we're not removed from the issues of the District of Columbia. We're a federal agency, but we have an exclusive local mission. I want to repeat that. We're a federal agency with an exclusive local mission. That means that we only focus on the District of Columbia and D.C. code offenders. Since its creation, CSOSA has existed to serve public safety in the District of Columbia. And as the director, I felt compelled to offer an accurate perspective to the one that was promoted in these articles in the Post about the D.C. criminal justice system, and mostly about our employees who are serious about their work and committed to the mission to enhance public safety here. And we're very effective in the work that we do. The notion of repeat violent offenders and second chances has been perpetuated in the articles in the Post, and I think that they've been offered as a criticism of our philosophy. So I want to be very clear, we are in the business of second chances. That is our business. I say that because releasing authorities make decisions to give 17,000 individuals under supervision a chance to succeed in the community and contribute to public safety. So the complexity of our work can be easily misunderstood, and we often work with marginalized individuals who are confronted with competitive employment markets, low levels of education, decreased housing options, and inadequate treatment. And I think treatment is really critical to discuss because mental health issues, as you've seen across the country, certainly is raising a concern here in the District of Columbia with many of the incidents that have been reported. The options for individuals under the criminal justice system with mental health problems is woefully undertreated, and inadequate treatment options are available for them. So we continually work with the city government, all the city agencies, all our criminal justice partners, to execute the work that we do, and we're very successful at what we do. If you look at the website of the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Statistics, 81% of the probationers complete supervision successfully, and for parolees or those under supervised release, 28 were reincarcerated, which is
commensurate
with the national
average. I wanted to get to that,
average.
Because if, in fact, 81% of the offenders complete the rehabilitation process successfully, that will never make the news.
No.
The only thing that makes the news is when things go wrong. When
that's
things
true.
Happen the way they're supposed to, that's not news. And that recent series that you referred to in the Washington Post focused on what went wrong when repeat offenders and D.C.'s Youth Rehabilitation Act didn't seem to work properly. The 1980s era law, the Youth Rehabilitation Act, is aimed at giving younger offenders a second chance. However, it has led to some violent offenders ending up back on the streets, including one highlighted in the series, Antoine Pitt. But let's not focus on him. Sentencing does not fall under your agency, but it seems that the patchwork system of federal and D.C. agencies failed to keep people like that, or some people like that, off the streets, because this case was not an isolated one. Where are the holes in the system that can cause things to go wrong?
Well, D.C. is unique because we do have federal and local jurisdiction over law enforcement in the city of Washington. However, it's important to note that we are not a broken system. The continuum of law enforcement and justice in D.C. has worked together over several decades, over at least two decades now, to look at issues, gaps, problems in the District of Columbia and come up with solutions to those issues. So although the public is not always aware of how we close those gaps, the work has definitely been on behalf of public safety here in D.C. I don't know how this whole notion of a broken system.
Oh, I know.
Well, can you tell
me? Outgoing Police Chief Kathy Lanier said the system is beyond broken, and it seems that we cannot talk about criminal justice in the District of Columbia without that particular quote. As you notice, I didn't use it today, so please go ahead.
I appreciate that, because I think that that statement was made without any supporting documentation, so it was just a drop-the-mic kind of statement, which is unfortunate. I feel that it undermines the work, the hard work that all the continuum of law enforcement agencies in the city do every single day. For example, many of us are working together to make sure that we execute warrants. I have staff that we've located within the U.S. Marshals Services Agency to execute any warrants that are outstanding for our individuals under our supervision. We co-located a staff member in the Metropolitan Police Department so that we could share information constructively and quickly every single day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on any individuals of interest to the police department and to us so that that information is exchanged. Thirdly, as you've heard about the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, which I used to head, and at the time that I headed it, we started a system called the Justice Information Sharing System, JUSTIS. That system was put in place so that 17 agencies, which were historically not able to share criminal justice information across their agencies on a real-time basis, can now share information.
How, I guess, quickly is that information shared?
Because it's real time. When I say real time, I mean the police department can go in their cars, on their laptops at any given time, or on their handheld devices, iPads, etc., and look into justice and find out where an individual in the criminal justice system is. Are they under supervision? Are they up for a status hearing in the court? Are they confined in the Department of Corrections? Where are they across our criminal justice system? Have they been charged by the U.S. Attorney's Office? All kinds of information is shared in that system real time on a daily basis.
Let's talk about one specific aspect of
it. And 17 agencies, by the way.
A number of cases, including the rape case highlighted in the Post series, have pointed to the problem of convicted offenders removing their GPS tracking devices. And I'll quote from the Post and see what's incorrect, or you can tell us what's incorrect. When someone removes a device, CISOSA sends that person a certified letter, then waits for that letter to be returned undeliverable. They then take 18 days to try to find that person. They then get 3 days to write a report and deliver it to the judge. It takes 30 days for the judge to have a hearing. The entire process, according to the Post, can take 50 to 60 days to find out if the person is really an absconder.
Okay.
D.C. police say that unless they specifically inquire about an individual, they would not know.
Okay. So the Post was confusing several things there, or in your representation of what they said, it was confusing.
Direct quote.
Well, they were confused in it. And I understand, because it is a very complex system and there are nuances to our system. First of all, they're confusing with what we call the loss of contact process with monitoring of GPS. GPS, as you know, is a tracking device that individuals who are in need of it are placed under electronic monitoring so that we can track where they are at any given time during the day. If they are tamper with that device, it may mean that we have to go and find out why they're tampering with it and what exactly is going on with the device. But that can't be confused with the loss of contact. So let me talk about GPS first, and then I'll go to the loss of contact discussion.
And my quote from Aaron Davis was from his appearance on the show last week, not from the article in the Post.
But right, and Aaron, of course, he's never running an agency, so he doesn't know all there is to know about how things work with CISOSA. And so I understand that it can be very confusing. But the reality is that the GPS device, we do 24/7 monitoring of GPS. We use it as a tool of supervision and a condition that the judges place, or the U.S. Parole Commission place, on an individual. Up to recently, when we use it as a condition of release, we could actually charge an individual with tampering if they attempted to remove the device, which then notifies us that they are attempting to remove it, we can charge them with tampering and work with the MPD and the U.S. Attorney's Office. Recently, we were able to modify that legislation so that we could actually charge them as well if they tamper with it. And we're just
last week, Mayor Bowser signed legislation that makes it easier to prosecute people who tamper with their GPS monitoring devices.
That's right. And actually, Sesosa was the first one to address that issue in 2015, and the mayor and the city council picked it up again this year and actually moved it as emergency legislation, which we're very happy about.
Do have to take another break, a short break. We'll be right back to continue this conversation. If you have called, stay on the line. A number of people have called wanting to point out some of the accomplishments of the agencies. But you too can call, whether you're critical or an admirer of the agency, at 800-433-8850. What are your top concerns for repeat offenders in the District of Columbia? 800-433-8850. Do you think the district gives too many chances to young offenders, allowing violent criminals back on the streets or not? You can also send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. I'm Kojo Nandi.
This month at WAMU, we're lifting our voices to shine a light on Black changemakers throughout American history. Some you know and some you don't, but they all change the world. Hear the stories of these incredible scientists, activists, artists, and more throughout February on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at WAMU.org.
Welcome back. Our guest is Nancy Weir. She is the director of the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency for the District of Columbia, known generally as CSOSA. I know a lot of people who have called want to get in on this conversation, but before I get to the phones, let's get to the issue that you mentioned earlier about information sharing. D.C. police say they're often not made aware of offenders who have violated parole or probation. What's the process for sharing of information with law enforcement? How and when does CSOSA communicate with D.C. police when they're trying to locate an offender?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. We have a very good relationship with MPD. We've worked with them over the years to establish a memorandum of understanding on how we will share information. And to do that, as I mentioned earlier, we've embedded one of our staff in the Metropolitan Police Department's headquarters to work with them every time that they have a commander meeting, anytime they have a concern about an individual who's under our supervision. She shares information from our agency with their agency and vice versa. If they have someone that they're concerned about, they will let us know, and we will be able to let them know if that person is under supervision.
But that assumes that this person has come to their attention. What if a person absconds, cuts off his or her GPS device, but has not yet come to the attention of the police department, but nevertheless has the potential of maybe committing a crime? How would the police know that?
Well, there are several avenues. One is if we have different levels of risk that we supervise. Our highest risk level individuals, we try to make sure that we're monitoring very closely, and we provide most of the resources that we have available to us to that population. So if we have an individual who we have determined is in loss of contact, and that means that we've gone through a variety of mechanisms to be sure that that person will not come back into compliance, then we can notify the police department, and in many cases do, so that we can let them know that we're concerned about that individual and they are out there. We're definitely looking at that more closely with our agency and theirs, and I've talked to the interim police chief to determine how he best wants to get information shared with them. We also address issues that we're concerned about with our individuals who come out of prison, come back under supervision, or are placed under supervision by the courts, so that we can, each new individual that comes under supervision, we share that information with the police department so they will know who's under our jurisdiction and who we're concerned about.
Here now is Thomas in Washington, D.C. Thomas, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Thomas Penny. I'm the general manager of the Courtyard Marriott Convention Center, and I've also been a part of the Hotel Association in D.C. For over 20 years. And we've had various iterations of relationships with the director and the agency, and we've joined them to assist with some of the workforce development that they've done. We've also hired some of their clients, and our experience has been a positive one. As a matter of fact, there is some ground shifting on this issue, and my concern, some of these Post articles have the ability and the potential of slowing that down. For example, last year we had the vice president of a national hotel management company to come and request to meet to talk about devising a program that was specific to returning citizens, and that had never happened in my 20 years of being in the city. And so I think that it's imperative that we get the positive stories out to counter the few less than positive ones, because there are some amazing success stories of some of the clients of the agency transitioning doing exceptionally well.
Okay, Thomas, thank you very much for your call. I'd like to move on to Andrew in Washington, D.C. Andrew, your turn.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I want to commend the director for any positive changes made. I want to recognize, based on the last caller's comments, that a lot of it depends upon the offender or the ex-offender and their wanting to make the change, and how much CSOSA's role in that may or may not play into that. But more importantly, director, you have situations, I think, at times where you have low-level offenders. You have agents assigned to them who may not be well qualified to deal with their situations, who don't follow protocol or procedure. You've talked about mental health issues. How is your agency working to deal with mental health issues? A lot of people in D.C. jails suffer from mental health issues and receive medication. And then lastly, what programs are you assigning? Because I didn't get a lot of help from any of your people with finding a job, and I was told that was a condition to be successful in my supervision.
Okay. Thank you so much for your comments. First, I'll mention the training of our staff. Our staff are highly trained and continually trained to work with the emerging issues as we see them in the District of Columbia amongst our population. So we do provide constant training. We also have shifted our supervision techniques, and I don't know when you were under supervision or if you're still under supervision, but we've shifted our supervision techniques to expand our teams. We now have behavioral health teams because we were seeing an increase in the numbers of individuals who have behavioral health issues and come under supervision. We do not provide treatment to those individuals. Let me repeat that. What we do not provide treatment, but we work with the District of Columbia's Department of Behavioral Health and their core service agencies to connect our folks who are under supervision with their services. Now, the director of that department and I have been in constant conversations about modifying the treatment options available to individuals who are involved in the criminal justice system, because we see there are issues specific to this population that really need to be addressed and well monitored in a different context.
As an independent federal entity, CSOSA does not have the same resources that a state or city-run agency would, meaning that mental health services, housing, drug treatment, that kind of thing. Is that something you would like to see CSOSA have? Is that?
Well, actually, across the country, CSOSA has unique resources that most states do not have for probation and parole. So that is another misconception. And if you were to research how other agencies conduct the business of probation and parole supervision, you will see that as an agency, we are well-positioned and well-resourced to provide a unique range of evidence-based practices to the men and women that we supervise. So we have a pretty strong range of resources available, particularly as it relates to those who are our highest-risk population.
I'm going to shut up and let our listeners do the talking from now on, because we don't have much time left. Jason in Columbia Heights, you're on the air. Jason, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I want to thank you for having Director Nancy Ware on today. Director Ware, I have a question for you about the whole notion of high risk versus low risk.
Yes.
I wonder if you could explain that a little bit more detail and the difference between the offense somebody might have in their background from 5 years ago 10 years ago, and when that person comes back to the community and you're now looking at their quote-unquote risk and what that means to the general person in terms of how you work with this person?
Very good question. As you know, we receive individuals who are placed under our supervision by the courts on probation. That means that they're in the community, they go directly from the court to the community, or they're placed under supervision by the U.S. Parole Commission, which means that they come out of institutions, the Bureau of Prison in particular, back to supervision in the community. That means that when they get to us, we have a very sophisticated risk assessment that determines risks and needs of the individuals that we supervise. We categorize them from minimum risk to public safety to the highest risk of public safety so that we can carefully monitor our highest risk individuals differently than how we monitor our lowest risk individuals. Science has shown us and research has shown us that the resources of probation and parole need to be specifically targeted to our highest risk. The highest risk are determined by their criminal background, that is, whether they've had histories of violent crime in their history, criminal history, the incarceration concerns and the numbers of incarcerations, their adjustment in the community, whether they have strong ties with family or support systems in place for them so that they can be stabilized more readily. Those are some of the things that we take into consideration for our highest risk.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and we got a tweet from Marissa who writes, who holds CISOSA accountable? And CISOSA is an independent executive branch agency. You report not to the Justice Department, rather to the executive branch. So technically, you report to the President of the United States. But in practice, how much involvement and oversight does the executive branch exercise over the agency? How is that done? In other words, who exactly do you report to?
I am appointed by the President of the United States. However, we have a number of accountability measures, and we engage in robust performance reporting in consultation with local and federal stakeholders. For example, our performance management and reporting has to meet GPRA standards. That's government performance measurements that are available on our website for the public to view, which is unique to many states. You can't find their performance measures on their website. We make recidivism and other performance data available to Congress and the public. We've also initiated meetings with the Executive Office of the Mayor and the Council to discuss our operations and practices, because we do specifically deal with D.C. code offenders only. And we have made several formal public hearings with Congress. We've had annual budget meetings with Congress, the House, and the Senate Appropriations Committees. Quarterly, we have to provide financial and operational status reports to both chambers of Congress. Biannual congressional staff site visits are conducted. Congressional stakeholder meetings to request input and approval of our strategic plan or requested legislative changes to our authorizing statute.
All the time we have.
I could go on and on.
We will continue these conversations in the weeks ahead, including talking to victims who have been affected by the system. But Nancy Weir is the director of the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency for the District of Columbia, known as CISOSA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kojo. I appreciate the time.
Be sure to meet us back here tomorrow at noon. We'll discuss the issues to watch as Maryland's lawmakers convene for the start of the General Assembly session. Plus, First Lady Michelle Obama made healthy eating her signature issue and planted the first White House garden. We will look at the programs the movement sparked locally and what's next. We did have one phone call who couldn't stay on the line who said that there was an individual who has a GPS device who committed several crimes in her neighborhood. The police always caught him and returned them because he had a GPS device. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Elizabeth Weinstein, Ruth Tam, and Avery Kleinman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Nandi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.